Welcome to Science and Technology Week at the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and all this week we've been revisiting our favorite science and technology conversations. Coming up later this hour, why older Americans are more vulnerable to misinformation online. Plus, some research that shows why you should just leave your phone at home for your next walk in the park. But first, how much of your life is about decisions you make, and how much of it was already determined at birth? That's the nature versus nurture debate that's at the heart of many issues, whether we're thinking about public health, education, or economic mobility. Well, according to researchers at Northwestern University, the answer might be neither. That's because of the way the human genome actually works. And a new study shows that experiencing poverty actually affects our genes in a significant way. Thomas McDade is the lead author of this study. He's a professor of anthropology and a faculty fellow at Northwestern's Institute for Policy Research. Kaylin Ryan was part of the research team. He's a PhD candidate at Northwestern, specializing in human biology and reproductive ecology. I spoke with both of them about this back in April, and I started by asking Tom what made him interested in this topic.
Well, you know, broadly speaking, we know, and we have known for a long time, that that poverty sucks, right, in so many ways, but especially for your health. And people who have lower access to socioeconomic resources and the privileges it entails live shorter lives. And the lives that they live, they suffer from a wide range of diseases at higher rates, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, dementias, mental illnesses like depression, infectious diseases. And individuals at the extremes, the lowest of the income to the highest income distribution in the United States, it could be a 10 to 15 year difference in life expectancy across these groups. So we've known this for a long time. What we don't know is how it is that the experiences of socioeconomic adversity and poverty, particularly early in life, how these, to use a phrase in my line of research that we often use, how do these experiences get under the skin? At some level, these experiences have to shape our physiology. They have to shape function of our biology at the cellular level to have a lasting impact on our health. And we don't know how that happens. So the study was designed to address that question, and we were focusing on a category of regulation within cells that we term epigenetics. And epigenetics literally means epi, above the genome. And it's a class of biochemical processes that shape the structure of the genome. So we inherit genes from our parents. Those sequences are fixed at birth. But then lots of marks can get laid down on top of the genome that shape the structure and function of those genes, the likelihood that they get expressed. So epigenetics refers to a class of processes that change the activity of a gene, but they actually don't change the sequence. And there's a lot of interest in public health and in anthropology and psychology and demography in this process as a potential biological mechanism that can link environments like poverty with health later in life. So that was the broad motivation for the study.
And that makes a lot of sense. Kaylin, though, can you give us an example of epigenetics in terms of what we know about how that might change someone's genetic makeup?
So as Tom was saying, it doesn't technically change the genetic makeup. But if you look at the DNA, an example would be something called DNA methylation. And that's a tag that exists on the DNA. And you can think of it as sort of a switch that affects when and how the gene is expressed. And so when we look at those switches, we can sort of see differences. An example would be between tissue that has cancer and tissue that's healthy. There's a lot of these switches that start to turn and go in one direction or the other. And you can also see evidence of that with certain diseases, obesity or type 2 diabetes, for example.
Okay. So in that case, how did you guys even go about determining how poverty can have an epigenetic effect?
So what we did, this is part of a long-term study in Cebu in the Philippines, and in 2005, after lifelong information about the social and environmental context that people were living in, we were able to take blood samples from them. And in that blood, there's cells, and those cells have DNA in them. And so we can drill down into that DNA, technically speaking, and find across the DNA different marks. and then we can then attribute those to the nearby genes and start to understand what genes are getting switched on or switched off based on the social and economic environments that those people are experiencing.
And Tom, how long has this study been going on? You were following a group of people from what time period?
Yeah, the study was initiated in 1983, and it began with the recruitment of more than 3,000 women who are pregnant. They gave birth to their babies, and the moms and their babies have been followed up ever since. So it's a pretty incredible data resource for understanding how environments early in life and throughout the transition through childhood and adolescent, how they shape physiology and health later in life.
And so what did you guys find, Tom?
Well, we found that we found a very strong pattern of association between our measure of socioeconomic status, which was a composite of household income, assets, and education level in the household. That was a very strong predictor of the number of methylation sites across the genome that were methylated along the lines of the process that Kaylin was describing. So we found that more than 2,500 methylation sites were significantly predicted by the level of SES you had during your life, and that those 2,500 methylation sites were embedded in more than 1,500 genes across the genome. And that was quite surprising to us, the large number of methylation sites and the large number of genes that we found significantly associated with SES. You know, there were only about 20,000 genes in the human body. So rounding up a little bit, nearly 10% of the genes in the participants in our sample were associated significantly with socioeconomic status.
So just to understand what you're saying here, because it's a little technical, but basically you're saying your socioeconomic status can help determine the marks on your about 10% of our genetic makeup?
That's correct. So there's no association in our sample between the genes that these people inherited and their level of socioeconomic status. That's just random. But the level of socioeconomic status that they had in infancy and through their young adulthood predicted the level of methylation on 1,500 genes across the genome. So it along the lines of what Kaylin was saying, it influenced the switches of more than 2,500 switches across 1,500 genes in the genome of these participants.
And what kind of switches are we talking about here, Tom, in regards to what sorts of things?
Yeah, well, it's a large number of genes, right? It's 1,500. So broadly speaking, there are some biological themes that emerge, and they have to do with skeletal development of the nervous system, and the function and activation of the immune system. But it's hard for us to determine exactly what the downstream health effects of those associations will be, and that's something we're planning to do in the future by following these participants up. I think the key finding, though, and why this study is potentially significant, is that we find such a large number of hits across such a large swath of the genome. And that's commensurate with what we know about how socioeconomic status can shorten lives and impact a wide range of physiological systems and increase risk for a wide range of diseases. And so this study suggests that the impact of socioeconomic status is spread pretty far and wide across the genome, and that, I think, is potentially important.
We're speaking with Tom McDade, who's a professor of anthropology and a faculty fellow at Northwestern's Institute for Policy Research, and Kaylin Ryan, a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology, about their research looking at, as we've been talking about, this epigenetic layer and how these switches have changed depending on socioeconomic status in the group that they've been researching for more than 30 years at this point. It looks like you guys there have 30 years of data you've been looking at. Tom, were you surprised by these findings?
I was surprised that we got such a large number of associations. And to me, it's quite compelling. It challenges us to think a little bit differently about genetics and the genome. To me, it's really great evidence for the importance of the environment impacting how our genes are, how they function and how they're structured. You know, we tend to think of genes as inherited, fixed at conception, and somehow defining of our destinies. But this study and others in this area of epigenetics really force us to think of genes and the genome more broadly. Genes are literally the structure and the function of our genes has literally changed in relation to experience over developmental time. And I think that changes the way we think about genes and how they might affect our health as well as other things we might care about.
Kaylin, I mentioned you're a PhD candidate. I wonder how this study has affected your research areas and what you're thinking about researching in the future.
That's a good question. Actually, I worked in non-human animals, and I became interested in this type of research, and particular in working with the Cebu population. It's a very rich data set, and there's a lot of questions we can ask that are pretty difficult to ask in humans. It's very hard to separate biology from the social world we live in, and Cebu is a good place to at least start to do that. And so this is kind of an important part of my development as a scientist and scholar in terms of thinking about what biology we do inherit and how does that interact with the world we live in. And so that's why I think this and some of the other things that we're involved in really start to challenge those old dichotomies of nature and nurture and the fact that a lot of this has the potential for having long-term implications for understanding our health and what inequality does for our health is really important.
Kaylin, do you think that even using the whole idea of nature versus nurture is even the wrong way to frame our thinking around genetics and poverty and health and other things?
I absolutely do. I think the nature versus nurture is sort of gone with the 20th century, I think. I've heard people say nature via nurture and other ways of interpreting these things, but there really isn't a clear boundary between what nature is and what nurture is. That we can, the further you go down into the molecular world, the harder it gets to distinguish between one and the other, because we are living organisms in a world that we interact with constantly, whether it's the microbiome or whether it's the food we eat or the pollution or toxins in the environment. Everything affects our genes and everything affects our biology in some way.
That said, Tom, I wonder how policymakers should think about, particularly when we're thinking about poverty, if you think this should change the conversation a little bit.
Yeah, well, my hope is that studies like this provide further evidence for the fact that adversity, poverty, literally becomes embedded in our biologies, in this case in a deep way, in the genome, shaping the structure of our genes. And to me, that provides additional evidence that should mobilize support for policies that help reduce levels of poverty. That's outside my area of expertise to advise on exactly how to do that. But, you know, over the past 40 years, levels of income inequality in the United States have increased dramatically. And that was as a result of a series of policy decisions. So our current situation is not an inevitable one, and I think there are ways that we could hopefully reduce that current trend. I do think it's important that we not use this kind of research to replace one sort of simplistic biological determinism with another one, right? And so there's a lot of emphasis on genes and DNA as destiny, as some causal force that is really important in our health. And this line of research has the potential to sort of replace one sort of determinism with another. And I think it's important to note that these kinds of factors, things leading to our health and how long we live, they are very complexly determined by multiple forces. So there's not going to be one silver bullet that solves all these problems, but I think we can all agree that anything we can do to improve the quality of environments and alleviate suffering associated with poverty, that would be a good thing in many dimensions.
And I wonder if this works in the inverse. Kaylin, Tom, like, do you feel like maybe there may be ways that our epigenetic layer, like we inherit things that are also really good for us as well?
Let me just finish this and Kaylin, you go. Epigenetic is a biological process through which our bodies experience the environment and take information in to shape the function of our physiological systems. That's important. Our bodies, we're born into this world, but we could be born into Evanston, downstate Illinois, or in Antarctica. And you want your body to be able to function as best as it can in different ecological settings based on the constraints and opportunities in those environments. Epigenetics is an important process through which our environments impact our genome and other aspects of our biology. So it's an essential process.
Yeah, Kaylin, we're almost out of time, but if you want to weigh in quickly.
No, I think Tom summed it up great. We're adapted to be adapted to our world, and development and epigenetics are an important part of that, both good and bad.
That's Kaylin Ryan, a PhD candidate at Northwestern University. He specializes in human biology and reproductive ecology. You also heard Tom McDade, a professor of anthropology and a faculty fellow at the university's Institute for Policy Research. I spoke about this with them in April. We'll tweet out the details of their research if you'd like to learn more. Welcome back to the special Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you think back to the 2016 election, it was a time when it seemed like fake news and misinformation was everywhere on social media. Since then, we've learned more about how misinformation spreads online and how well-equipped we are to handle it. There's also been an increase in funding for programs that promote digital and media literacy, supported in some cases with money from tech giants like Apple and Facebook. But many of those are designed for young people, even if a growing body of research suggests that our oldest citizens are the most vulnerable to false news and misinformation on the internet. That's the subject of a recent piece by Craig Silverman. He's BuzzFeed's media editor, and he joins us now from Toronto. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you.
Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Lisa Jamis. She's the manager of local programs at AARP. And in studio with me here in Urbana is Carol Tilley, who teaches at University of Illinois' School of Information Sciences. Lisa, Carol, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig, I wonder if we can start with you and just ask, when you feel like researchers started to learn more about the effects of misinformation, was it the 2016 election and the immediate aftermath?
The 2016 election and the immediate aftermath, and I think to a certain extent, the surprise that so many people had that Trump won, I think even Trump himself to a certain extent was surprised. There were a lot of people, average folks, as well as professionals and researchers who wanted to try and figure out, well, what were the factors that led to a surprising result? And I do think that suddenly a narrative about misinformation, about false stuff, particularly false things spreading on Facebook, that was part of the discussion. And so you had researchers, some of whom had been looking at that beforehand, but a bunch who kind of flooded the zone on this because it was suddenly an area of big interest. Whereas in the previous, you know, years, as somebody who was writing about this, it wasn't as much of an interest. And so, yeah, we had researchers who started to gather data, longer term studies, gather bigger data sets and look at bigger groups of people. And that sort of created a little mini boom over the last couple of years of really looking into that, with the data around the 2016 election being the main thing folks are focused on.
And Craig, are we mostly talking about Facebook when we're saying misinformation, or are there other places we're looking at this happening?
I do think that overall, our media ecosystem now, I mean, one of the great things about it is that it's much more democratized. It's easier to get your voice out as an individual or a smaller group, and that's a really good thing that the internet has done. At the same time, of course, when you have lots more voices, it's more chaotic, it's a more confusing environment. And so while Facebook is incredibly dominant, I mean, we're talking about 2.5 billion people around the world at least logging in every month, and a lot doing it much more frequently than that. That's the biggest population. But the truth is that we do have misinformation, meaning, you know, misleading stuff, false stuff that is spreading across all platforms. So it's not just a Facebook problem, but Facebook, if you're going to study it, that is the place that the most people are. That is the place where there's so much engagement and so much activity. And studies have also shown in recent years that it is a place that increasingly Americans and others are getting their news from.
So, Carol, when we think about that, I wonder if we can look at some of the research that points to the fact that older Americans are being more likely to share false news online. I mean, how much of that is also because of as we've seen the demographics of Facebook skew older?
I think there is something to the aging demographics of Facebook. But one of the things is I look at some of the polls and studies from Pew and other sites, there is, of course, a difference between, say, the under 40 age group and the over 40 or over 50 age group in terms of how they understand fake news and fact versus opinion. But I don't see such a huge difference between the two groups. I see it really as a smaller difference. I think that there are some shared problems, some shared lapses across all ages when it comes to thinking critically about information and knowledge.
And Carol, I wonder when we're thinking about older Americans, if it's just not something we talk about very much or think about, even if it's perhaps facing the same problems that you're seeing regardless of age when it comes to media or digital literacy. It's just that maybe we are leaving out older Americans in this conversation.
I think that's part of it, in part because I think as a culture, we tend to think of technology as a youth-focused sort of network, a youth-focused information tool. But it's clear that with social media, we're seeing adoption across a wide variety of age groups. I just think that older Americans in particular are, as you said, somewhat more invisible.
Lisa James is also with us from AARP. Lisa, I wanted to ask you about the work that you do with the Learn at 50 program and share some comments that we've been getting, because, of course, we went to Facebook to ask our older listeners what they thought about this. Patty from Berwyn said, this is a comment she posted on our Facebook page. She said, I am almost 70 and I can spot a comment by a Russian troll. I use my computer to fact check anything I doubt is true, and I share only what I know to be true. How common is a statement like Patty's mindset among the folks that you're working with, Lisa?
Well, I can tell you that you know, the technology workshops that we host in 38 markets across the country, we have everyone from your basic learner to someone who's there to learn even beyond the basics. We mostly the feedback that we get from the 50 plus who are attending those workshops, they are actually there more to, sometimes they'll talk about, I want to be safe online, which we do teach in the class, but they're also there really just to learn and connect and be able to connect with their grandkids and their family. So what we're finding is we don't have a lot of people coming into the workshops that are fearful. We do teach them the basics. Some of them, it's very basic, and we do teach them how to be safe online, but really the focus is helping them connect and be engaged and be challenged as they move through this, you know, this ever-changing digital age.
That's Lisa James with AARP. Craig Silverman is with us from BuzzFeed, and Craig actually attended one of these tech workshops in Washington for his story that he did. Craig, can I ask you, when we're thinking about whether it's folks at this workshop or just when we're looking at the population, Carol's point is that she feels like media literacy is a problem across age groups. But I wonder if there are factors that find that older Americans might be more likely to share misinformation.
I absolutely agree that we do have to think about this as not strictly a problem for the young or problem for the old. We have a dramatically different media environment. I think all of us struggle to a certain extent with it because it has changed so much so quickly. So it's, you know, it's good to focus on centers of the population that maybe seem a bit more vulnerable, but I think all of us should be wary of being too overconfident because it is a chaotic environment. And I mean, in terms of what we see with some of the other factors, you know, the researchers that I spoke to, they talk about the intersection between things like, you know, the levels of isolation and loneliness that some older Americans do experience. This is part of a kind of generational shift in the sense that there was a time when often the grandparents lived in the same house as the younger generations, and that's less common today. And so you have older people who maybe had the experience of living with their older relatives when they were younger, and now they're not doing that when they're older. And it's a different dynamic. And technology can be a wonderful benefit to that of, as you hear from AARP, of keeping them connected. But it's also if the guardrails aren't there for all of us online, any person can go awry. And I think that is something that is affecting older folks. It's not affecting anyone over 65. There are people with different levels of skill, as you hear. But as a sort of group of population, the researchers I've spoken to who've been doing this research, you know, when they control for other factors like partisanship or other things, they're saying that age is increasingly coming out as something across studies. It's not just one study, but you know, four different ones looking at the sharing and consumption of misinformation around 2016. All of them found that age seemed to be a factor that really stood out.
And Craig, to that point about that age being a factor, I also, in your reporting, you talk a little bit about the rising power of older Americans. And I think most people know that older Americans vote in larger numbers than other generations. But when we're thinking also just about demographics and we're looking at American culture, when we're looking at our rapidly aging population, this is also one of our largest age groups, right?
It is. And within not too many years, it will be the largest age group. You know, there's a titanic shift happening in the demographics of the United States and also countries like Canada, where you will have, at a point, have more people over 65 than more people, you know, under 25 and under. And that's not a typical demographic breakdown that we've seen in our societies. And so this is something where older people, you know, they already have a lot of kind of economic power, political power, because they vote and they're active and they're passionate. And that's probably going to increase. And I think it's really important to think about ways of making sure that they're part of all the conversation, that they're also adapting and that people are supporting them when it comes to technology and new things. Because if we all struggle, and some of us struggle more, it's something we should think about how we support each other. And that, to me, is one of the big takeaways, is it's not about shaming older people or lumping them all into one group. It's about thinking about how can we as a society support everyone for these challenges, but also identify who maybe deserves a little bit of extra help.
And Carol, to that point, regardless, as we're saying, regardless of age, how do you feel like people should, when we're thinking about media literacy, how do you know how to spot what's true or not? You know, this is something that I, as a journalist, do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. But I think even as Craig was talking, I was just thinking about the different kinds of forms of media and how that's changed during my lifetime, right? And how going from whether you were watching the evening news and that was your source of information, or you were reading a newspaper, and now as we're talking about more people getting their information from places like Facebook, how do we really determine whether or not something's true or not?
That's tough, even for folks like me who have a PhD in information science, and I've worked as a librarian, and I teach folks about this.
I mean, journalists
topic.
Get pulled sometimes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. I caught myself sharing something on Facebook last year that someone pinged me. I usually, you know, like triple check, and someone caught that and said, no, you just got had. But I think that one of the things that has to happen is just sort of this disposition to always be critical, to persevere, to check multiple sources. And that's tough because you can encourage people, I think, to do these things. You can put up reminder sheets. You can have programs. But at the end of the day, the disposition it's, at some level has to be intrinsic. It has to be internal, and people just have to want to do this.
And we want to share information quickly, right?
Right?
Craig, I wonder to that point, and Lisa, I would love to have you chime in on this as well. How much do you think the platforms and tech companies are basically designed it that way for us to just really make sharing so easy that we're not really thinking about checking things?
I mean, that is absolutely what they're optimized for. They're optimized and built to reduce all the friction. And they want you to interact. They want you to, whether it's, you know, a like or a share or a retweet, they want that interaction because obviously that, you know, that's a signal that they can then take and figure out, okay, a lot of people like this piece of content, let's show it to other people. And hopefully that gets everyone spending more time on it. So that's their bias. And what we have to realize is that people have become very good at exploiting that and understanding on a platform like Facebook, what kind of content is going to get people to have that quick reaction to sort of not have them sit and think about it? And what we've really seen is that it's all about emotion. It's all about getting anger or extreme happiness. It's about getting people to have an emotional reaction to a piece of content that causes them to have a sort of intrinsic reaction to like and share. And so for me, like, the big piece of advice for people is try to cultivate a certain amount of emotional skepticism. If you see something online and it makes your blood boil instantly, or, you know, it confirms everything you thought about someone, that's the moment where you should actually train yourself to pause just a little bit and ask yourself, where is this coming from? Am I familiar with this, you know, news outlet or website? And are there other sources saying the same thing? And that emotional skepticism, I think, is really important because of the way these platforms are built.
We got a comment on Facebook from Cindy who said, I just don't believe anything I hear. So clearly she is agreeing with you with that, Craig. Lisa, when you're thinking about the training that you guys are doing at AARP, how do you test whether programs like yours are working?
We actually our tech programs, which, as I mentioned, like to date, we've already done over 3,500 since 2014. It's one
wow.
of our most popular.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's amazing. We're doing 1,200 workshops this year, and they fill up, and they fill up fast. As a matter of fact, we have a number of workshops running in Chicago, if your listeners are interested. What we also do, not only do we get anecdotal feedback, a lot of times I personally will attend these workshops, and you can just hear the excitement and the passion. They're very interactive. They're hands-on. People are able to ask questions. But what we also do, we do surveys at the end of our workshops. And the satisfaction rates on those surveys are above 90% across the board on, you know, the technology and information I'm learning today is going to help me. The instructors were knowledgeable. AARP is helping me navigate, you know, technology in the digital age. So the technology classes are very, very popular and very well received. And I also want to shout out that at learn.aarp.org, if you go to in-person learning, AARP features all of our in-person classes that cover not just technology, but also caregiving and work jobs.
So I wanted to just wrap up here with one last Facebook comment we got, and it was from Penny in Decatur, and she said, quit making the assumption that we are as uneducated as younger people. And Carol, I wonder what your thoughts are on that, because I wonder if this really, it's not about education, right?
No, for me, in looking at the data and in talking with students, what I see is it's about the things that interest us, that engage us, and that sort of intrinsic motivation is what gets us to push past our biases, I think. Not always. It's not about age. It's not about education always.
Craig, I imagine you also want everyone to know that this is not about attacking an older generation. But I also wonder kind of what your biggest questions are after you've reported this piece, what you have going forward here.
But, you know, for me, the question is, what is the best way to engage with this group and to give them the skills they need? Because I do think, as much as we all struggle, there are probably different approaches to teaching and learning for different groups. There's been a lot of money, as you mentioned off the top, that has ended up really focused on younger students. And I feel like there's a focus there and there's still a lot of work to do, but it seems like it's starting to move in that direction. And so for me, the next question is, well, how do we get this out to people of all age groups, but in particular, the folks who are in the older age groups? How can we test things to see what resonates most with them and serve them and support them in ways that are going to be really helpful? I think thinking about those solutions and programs is another piece that's really important now.
That's Craig Silberman. He's the media editor at BuzzFeed, joining us from Toronto. I want to thank Lisa James for being with us as well. And we'll have those resources that Lisa mentioned, the sites that she mentioned about AARP at our website at 21stshow.org. We'll tweet those out as well. We'll post them on Facebook, on every social medium so you can see them. I want to thank Carol Tilley for being with us as well, U of I School of Information Sciences, where she is an associate professor. Craig, Carol, Lisa, thank you for being with me. I appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's becoming increasingly hard to unplug. You know what I mean. You've got cell phones and tablets, social media and games, and of course, the news. So today we're going to talk about taking a break from all of that by stepping outside and getting some fresh air. It seems logical that if you really want to take a break, you should leave your devices behind. But now we've got some scientific research that backs up that idea. Illinois landscape architect Bill Sullivan was one of the people behind that research. He's also head of the Department of Landscape Architecture at the U of I. He's with me now at WILL in our studios here. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the 21st.
Nyla, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us from the Morton Arboretum in Lyle is Brenda Spitzer, who's a forest therapy guide. Hi, Brenda. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me here.
Professor Sullivan, before we get to your research, what do we know about the benefits of nature for our brains?
Well, over the past 30 years or so, there's been a lot of research that's been conducted in universities around the world that shows that having regular contact with green spaces, even urban green spaces, can have really important impacts for our capacity to recover from mental fatigue, to recover from stress. Having a nature-rich neighborhood means that people are outside more often, and that leads to stronger social ties with neighbors. Recent studies show that there are implications for our immune system. And there's even work that shows that teenagers that are associated or that have greater contact with green spaces are in a better mood.
And Brenda, when you think about other, as Bill's talking about our mood, other aspects, I wonder what else you wanted to add in terms of the benefits you see for folks who are doing, and we're going to get into what your forest therapy is in a minute, but just the people who are doing work with you at the Morton Arboretum.
Well, we experience a lot of psychological benefits as you know, increased sense of well-being, relaxation, positive impact on depression. And time that people spend in the forest on my walks can also leave them feeling more calm, focused, more creative. Here at the Arboretum, we offer many nature-based educational programs to help people of all ages connect with and appreciate trees and nature.
And Bill, I wonder what happens when we introduce technology into these conversations. When we're thinking about technology and the outdoors, say we want to go for, I think lots of people, when they're going for a bike ride or even a walk, they're bringing their technology with them because they're listening to music.
I think if you're listening to music, you're probably getting some of the benefits of being in a green space. But if you're engaging in social media, if you're watching YouTube,
listening to a podcast,
yeah, listening to podcasts is interesting. I'm not sure about that.
Okay,
I think we need to explore that possibility.
And how did you conduct your research? So you studied a concept. Is it called attention restoration therapy? Can you explain what that means?
It's called attention restoration theory. And what it says is that it recognizes that we have two ways of attending to things in the world. Some things require no effort to pay attention to. Think of watching the campfire or a fire in the fireplace or a waterfall or a baby. In fact, there's some things that are really difficult not to pay attention to. If you see a toddler walking towards the staircase, for instance, or someone's telling a story next to you while you're trying to work and you hear this story about somebody being cheated, it's really hard not to have your attention focused on that story. Or wild animals. You see a deer or a fox outside your home, and it's all of a sudden you're just totally focused on them. And that kind of attending to things that are softly fascinating, requires no effort on your part. There's whole other category of things that are really important to us that we that we focus our attention on, that we consciously decide to attend to. Preparing for an interview, for instance, or doing the work that's associated with much of what we do in society today, schoolwork, teaching, grading, writing proposals, that kind of stuff.
So how did you set up this study? What did you ask your study participants to do to measure how distracted really we really can get?
Yeah, so we asked this question. We know from previous research that being in a green space allows you to recover from mental fatigue faster than if you were in a built space. And we also wondered whether or not if you had your cell phone or your laptop with you, does that interfere with the process of recovering from mental fatigue? So we set up this very simple experiment in which we had people on our campus here randomly assigned to four different conditions, a green space or a barren space, and within those two spaces, either to use or not use their laptop. And we simply had this question. If we get these people mentally fatigued and give them a break in the kind of space they're randomly assigned to, will they recover from the mental fatigue faster in one space or another? And that's what we did.
And what did you find out?
Well, we found out that if you make people mentally fatigued and then you measure their capacity to pay attention, then you give them a 10-minute or 15-minute break in one of these four kinds of spaces, then you come back and you measure their attention again, that the only space in which they were randomly assigned that people actually improved their attentional functioning was the green space in which they did not use their laptop. Another way to say this is, if you go to a green space or a barren space and you use your laptop, it was like that 15-minute break didn't occur at all.
So it didn't even make, it really was almost useless in terms of taking a break if you had a laptop with you.
If in terms of recovering from mental fatigue, it was worthless.
Brenda, does this surprise you?
No, it does not. On a forest therapy walk, for example, the objective of the walk is to give participants an opportunity to take a break from technology and the stresses of the daily life, 24-hour news cycle, and to just slow down and appreciate the details of nature that can only be noticed when they're moving very slowly through it. And the key to forest therapy is not to cover a lot of miles, but to just walk through nature with intention and take it all in.
So can you tell us what you help people do as a forest therapy guide at the Morton Arboretum, Brenda?
I sure can. At the Morton Arboretum, we have walks all year long for forest therapy. And on my walks, I always start out by having my participants all just get in touch with their senses and what they're noticing. I suggest they disconnect from their technology and put their to-do lists aside and think of our time together as time for them. And then I have them, you know, focus on the sense of touch and hearing and smell and just notice what it's like to be in the moment they're in that place. And after they've gotten in touch with their senses, what I have them do is just begin to move slowly along the trail. And I offer them a series of invitations, which are really just suggestions of how to connect with the natural world using their senses. And then periodically along the trail, we'll also stop and gather up and have an opportunity to share what we're noticing. And when we do share what we're noticing along the trail, it expands everyone's awareness.
How long do you normally do these walks for, Brenda?
The average walk is 3 hours in length, and we move very slowly because it covers just 1/4 to 1/2 mile. And this gives us lots of opportunity to notice details.
And Brenda, why are some reasons why folks are coming to you and people are telling you they're seeking out these forest therapy guided walks that you've been doing?
Well, people will come to me and tell me that, you know, they've been feeling so stressed because of the fast pace they move at, multitasking, maybe being stuck in traffic, and they just want a little escape from that, just like a little mental vacation, let's call it, where they can just take some time and relax and be in nature and use their senses.
We're talking, so yeah. Go ahead, Brenda.
For people, it's just a real break for people to be able to do that because, you know, sometimes it's hard to give ourselves permission to slow down and to just take some time for ourselves. And so one of the reasons I think a lot of people sign up for the walks, it gives them that permission and that opportunity.
And I imagine devices are not allowed on these walks, are they, Brenda?
They are not. Now, you know, sometimes people need to have a device with them, but I always suggest that at the very least they silence their devices. Sometimes, you know, maybe they have small children at home and they need to be able to be in touch. So as long as they silence their device, that helps quite a bit. If they can leave it in the car or turn it off, that's even better.
We're talking about nature and technology with Brenda Spitzer. She's been sharing her work as a forest therapy guide at the Morton Arboretum. Bill Sullivan's also in studio with me here in Urbana talking about his research. And Bill, when you look at the notion of technology and being outside, I wonder if you studied at all the effects of people with their phones and taking pictures, because I wonder how many people now in sort of our Instagram world are so focused on taking a picture that they're not maybe noticing what's actually, they're not experiencing things.
That's a very interesting question, Nyla, and it's something that we haven't studied yet, and, you know, that's a good idea. Maybe I'll write that down and see if we can include that in one of the upcoming studies. I think if you're focusing on the landscape in a way that captures your attention, there's probably a benefit to it. If you're focused on the composition of the picture or some distracting elements that you're trying to solve a problem, to the extent that you're solving a problem, that suggests that you wouldn't be getting the benefits of being in a green space. But if you're actually kind of enjoying, if you're taking a picture of the campfire and you're just kind of joyfully taking the snapshot, you're probably doing okay.
And when we're thinking about the length of these, Brenda was mentioning her forest therapy walks are about 3 hours long. When we're thinking about the idea of taking a break, I don't know if we have a sense of how long we need to be to take a break to recharge. You tested 15 minutes. I don't know if that was for the purposes of your studies. I wonder, is there a time, do you think there's a specific amount of time that you think is at least a minimum that people should be doing?
I'm sure that a three-hour walk in the Morton Arboretum is a wonderful experience, but the research suggests that you don't need nearly that long of an exposure to have a measurable difference. We did a study with high school students a couple of years ago in which a 10-minute break in a green space had a significant implications for their capacity to pay attention. People recover from stress in 5 to 6 minutes being in or having a view to a green space. So you don't even have to be in the green space, just a view to a green space. And we've got some studies that suggest even a short view of a few seconds can have an impact on your on physiological stress, kind of calm your heart rate, make you feel a little less stressed.
And Bill, as a landscape architect, I wonder how this research influences your design. We've been talking about how this helps individuals. How does this change your field and how you think about it?
You know, so much of the outstanding landscape architecture design in the world today deals with this stuff and does it in a wonderful fashion. This new study about using your device offers a little bit of a challenge to landscape architects because with this new finding, it suggests that we're going to have to up our game a little bit and maybe find ways to create landscapes that are a little bit more fascinating, that draw people's attention away from their
phones. Or jam devices.
Maybe. Green. Well, the problem is nobody's...
Device-free zones.
Who's going to go to those landscapes is the challenge.
Right. So, and I wonder, is it just, do you find it a challenge to just leave your device behind?
Sometimes I do.
Even knowing this research?
Sometimes I do.
Brenda, what would you say to convince people that it's okay to just leave your device behind for a little bit and just enjoy where they're at?
Well, I would tell them to just notice being in the present moment without your device and just give it a chance and see how much more they notice when they're moving slowly without a device and just paying attention to the details of the moment, to the ephemeral moment that they're in. That would be my advice.
And that's also great advice if people don't have access to a certified forest therapy guide such as yourself. We actually found you through a statewide guide. So we will tweet out that link to different forest therapy guides that are available throughout the state of Illinois. But I want to thank Brenda Spitzer for being with us. She's a forest therapy guide, as I've been saying, at the Morton Arboretum in Lyle. Bill Sullivan has also been with us. He's the head of the Department of Landscape Architecture at the University of Illinois and one of the authors behind this research, which we will tweet out as well, which I will give you permission to read on your devices. Bill, thanks to Bill. Brenda, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On Facebook, if you search for the 21st to like us, it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just head to our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boudou. Thanks for listening.